Welcome to Poems for Company. I'm your host, Brian Dillon. They are a daily presence in our lives. We look out our windows and we might see them. We maintain some awareness of their movements and of their noises. Yes, I'm talking about our neighbors. We're alert to changes on their property. Chimney work, a new paint job, fallen tree limbs, bicycles spilled out in the front of the house. If they post political yard signs, we might feel relieved, or else wonder, where do they get their misinformation? If you're fortunate enough to live next door to hen parents, I trust you enjoy listening to all the clucking, girls gone wild. When you recall the places where you lived, don't you inevitably think of who else was in close proximity? No man is an island entire of itself, John Donne said over 400 years ago. Don't most of us understand our place in our community, in our neighborhood, in the block we live on, in the context of those others who live so near to us? Today's episode deals with three distinct ways of thinking about one's neighbors. The first poem in Robert Frost's 1914 volume, North of Boston, presents a speaker walking the length of the stone wall that separates his property from his neighbor's property, and his neighbor is with him. They carry out an action familiar to both of them, secure the fallen boulders and smaller rocks that have been deliberately knocked over by intruders on their adjoining properties, or perhaps have fallen over due to weather shifts. In Frost's poem, Mending Wall, the weather is the culprit referred to in the opening lines, but soon we're told that hunters, or we could say slob hunters, are also to blame. Let's be alert to the contrast between the speaker, who may be a stand-in for Frost himself, and the speaker's neighbor, as they walk the line, talking as they work. This is Robert Frost's poem, Mending Wall. Something there is that doesn't love a wall, that sends the frozen groundswell under it and spills the upper boulders in the sun and makes gaps even two can pass abreast. The work of hunters is another thing. I have come after them and made repair where they have left not one stone on a stone, but they would have the rabbit out of hiding to please the yelping dogs. The gaps, I mean. No one has seen them made or heard them made, but at spring mending time we find them there. I let my neighbor know beyond the hill, and on a day we meet to walk the line and set the wall between us once again. We keep the wall between us as we go, to each the boulders that have fallen to each, and some are loaves and some so nearly balls we have to use a spell to make them balance. Stay where you are until our backs are turned. We wear our fingers rough with handling them. Oh, just another kind of outdoor game, one on a side. It comes to little more. There where it is, we do not need the wall. He is all pine, and I am apple orchard. My apple trees will never get across and eat the cones under his pines, I tell him. He only says, good fences make good neighbors. Spring is the mischief in me, and I wonder if I could put a notion in his head. Why do they make good neighbors? Isn't it where there are cows? But here there are no cows. Before I built a wall, I'd ask to know what I was walling in or walling out, and to whom I was like to give offense. Something there is that doesn't love a wall, that wants it down. I could say elves to him, but it's not elves exactly, and I'd rather he said it for himself. I see him there bringing a stone grasped firmly by the top in each hand, like an old stone savage armed. He moves in darkness, as it seems to me, not of woods only and the shade of trees. He will not go behind his father's saying, and he likes having thought of it so well, he says again, good fences make good neighbors. Robert Frost, Mending Wall. Two of the lines are repeated. Something there is that doesn't love a wall. That's the opening line. The severe cold conditions in New England thwart some of the best crafted stone fences, the poem declares at the start. But when the line is repeated much later in the poem, the speaker has moved to a more abstract level, implying that there's something inherently unneighborly about the fence the two men repair. The second line that gets repeated is said by the neighbor himself. Good fences make good neighbors. That's the only direct line attributed to this neighbor. We're told he inherited this principle from his father. The poem closes with this line. Usually, opening and closing lines in a poem call for our special attention. I suppose many readers who have even a faint recollection of reading this poem when younger might think it's a principle endorsed by Frost himself. But it's a glib and rigid view on how to be a good neighbor. Frost's speaker devotes so many lines to his own appeal that fences may be unnecessary or even harm what could be a more mutually satisfying relationship. And yet, Frost often is a slippery writer. He doesn't seem to say all walls should be knocked down so that we might be able to draw closer to our neighbor. In fact, in this poem, there's no suggestion the speaker would like to know his neighbor better. He speaks in unflattering terms about his fellow wall-mending man. Quotes, he moves in darkness, as it seems to me, not of woods only and the shade of trees. End quotes. The speaker certainly does not consider his neighbor the least bit enlightened. Maybe, though, Frost can encourage his reader to be more skeptical about the role of fences and neighbors. Mending Wall is written in blank verse. Each line consists of 10 syllables that typically follow a pattern of an unstressed, then a stressed syllable. Sometimes Frost uses 10 words to form his 10 syllables. And on a day we meet to walk the line. The stress variation is not so obvious, but is an attempt to mimic genuine speech, most obviously when the speaker and his neighbor speak aloud, but even when Frost's speaker confides in us. Quotes, he moves in darkness, as it seems to me. Shakespeare frequently relied on blank verse to capture the rhythms of the speech of his various characters. Again, let's hear Robert Frost's Mending Wall. Something there is that doesn't love a wall, that sends the frozen groundswell under it and spills the upper boulders in the sun. It makes gaps even two can pass abreast. The work of hunters is another thing. I have come after them, and made repair, where they have left not one stone on a stone, but they would have the rabbit out of hiding to please the yelping dogs. The gaps, I mean, no one has seen them made or heard them made, but it's spring mending time, we find them there. I let my neighbor know beyond the hill, and on a day we meet to walk the line and set the wall between us once again. We keep the wall between us as we go. To each, the boulders that have fallen to each, and some are lobes, and some so nearly balls, we have to use a spell to make them balance. Stay where you are until our backs are turned. We wear our fingers rough with handling them. Oh, just another kind of outdoor game, one on a side. It comes to little more. There, where it is, we do not need the wall. He is all pine, and I am apple orchard. My apple trees will never get across and eat the cones under his pines, I tell him. He only says, good fences make good neighbors. Spring is the mischief in me, and I wonder if I could put a notion in his head. Why do they make good neighbors? Isn't it where there are cows? But here there are no cows. Before I built a wall, I'd ask to know what I was walling in or walling out, and to whom I was like to give offense. Something there is that doesn't love a wall, that wants it down. I could say elves to him, but it's not elves exactly, and I'd rather he said it for himself. I see him there, bringing a stone grasped firmly by the top in each hand, like an old stone savage armed. He moves in darkness, as it seems to me, not of woods only, and the shade of trees. He will not go behind his father's saying, and he likes having thought of it so well, he says again, good fences make good neighbors. In this poem's long life since its 1914 publication, in ways that Frost never could have imagined, readers might think of it in relation to the Berlin Wall, constructed in 1961, torn down in 1989. Or think of various walls running through neighborhoods in Belfast, Northern Ireland, still standing despite the peace accords signed in 1997. These walls separate Catholic from Protestant communities, where religious beliefs still form severe tribal rivalries. Or think of it in regard to the current president's wall construction on the southern border of the U.S., intended to keep others seeking a better life out of this country. Frost could not have anticipated the role walls would play in these conflicted zones, but he did urge us to think about what such walls may mean. Quotes, before I built a wall, I'd ask to know what I was walling in or walling out, and to whom I was like to give offense. In this next poem, the speaker evaluates the owner of the home with whom he shares a wall. The poem is from 16th century England, but don't let that put you off. The speaker praises his neighbor with whom he has lived wall to wall for an entire decade. I'm going to read the first four lines and then pause to offer an explanation because, to our ears, these lines are not as reader-friendly as we would like them to be. Accounted our commodities, few more commodious reason sees than is this one commodity, quietly neighbored to be. That is, when we consider what we hold valuable, our benefits or advantages in life, we reason that few features are more valuable than to live next door to a quiet neighbor. Some additional translations from 16th century language to our own will be offered eventually, but I presume you will understand this poem well enough on a first hearing without my further preliminary explanations. This is John Heywood's A Quiet Neighbor. Accounted our commodities, few more commodious reason sees than is this one commodity, quietly neighbored to to be, which neighborhood in thee appears. For we two, having 10 whole years dwelt wall to wall, so joiningly that whispering soundeth through well nigh, I never heard thy servants brawl more than thou hadst had none at all. Nor can I no way make avaunt that ever I heard thee give them taunt. Thou art to them, and they to thee, more mild than mute. Mum ye be. I hear no noise mine ease to break. Thy buttery door I hear not creak. Thy kitchen cumbereth not by heat. Thy cooks chop neither herbs nor meat. I never heard thy fire once spark. I never heard thy dog once bark. I never heard once in thy house so much as one peep of one mouse. I never heard thy cat once mew. These praises are not small nor few. I bear all water of thy soil, whereof I feel no filthy foil, save water which doth wash thy hands, wherein there none annoyance stands. Of all thy guests set at thy board, I never heard one speak one word. I never heard them cough nor hem. I think thence to Jerusalem. For this neighborly quietness, thou art the neighbor neighborless. For ere thou wouldst neighbor annoy, these kinds of quiet to destroy, thou rather wouldst to help that matter at home alone fast bread and water. John Heywood's A Quiet Neighbor. The speaker praises how quiet his neighbor is. He does not hear him scold his servants. He cannot avaunt or boast that he hears his neighbor taunt the servants, nor even hear the servants complain. The speaker says he does not even hear the buttery door, the food pantry door, creak, or even kitchen block chopping noises, or dogs barking, or the fire sparking. He's not aware, over the course of 10 years, of his neighbor tossing bodily waste, his filthy foil or sewerage, onto their shared outdoor space. When his neighbor hosts guests, the speaker does not hear their dialogue, not even a cough or hem or clearing of the throat. If we presume Heywood writes autobiographically, we should marvel at the restraint of his neighbor. The speaker does not suggest whether he himself is quiet, but at least he recognizes a model of respectful neighborliness adjoining his own walls. The poem's closure is a bit tricky. I think thence to Jerusalem, he says. He strains to push his high praise into a religious zone. Rather than annoy another, his next-door neighbor would fast alone on bread and water if it would ensure the noise level remains low. A self-sacrificing, next-door or adjoining wall neighbor. Published in 1556, a mere 470 years ago, Heywood's poem speaks of the kind of neighbor many of us would appreciate. Again, this is John Heywood's A Quiet Neighbor. Accounted our commodities, few more commodious reason sees than is this one commodity, quietly neighbored to be, which neighborhood in thee appears. For we two, having 10 whole years dwelt wall to wall so joiningly that whispering soundeth through well nigh, I never heard thy servants brawl more than thou hadst had none at all. nor I can no way make avaunt that ever I heard thee give them taunt. Thou art to them, and they to thee, more mild than mute. Mum ye be. I hear no noise, mine ease to break. Thy buttery door I hear not creak. Thy kitchen cumbereth not by heat. Thy cooks chop neither herbs nor meat. I never heard thy fire once spark. I never heard thy dog once bark. I never heard once in thy house so much as one peep of one mouse. I never heard thy cat once mew. These praises are not small nor few. I bear all water of thy soil, whereof I feel no filthy foil, save water which doth wash thy hands, wherein there none annoyance stands. Of all thy guests set at thy board, I never heard one speak one word. I never heard them cough nor hem. I think thence to Jerusalem. For this neighborly quietness, thou art the neighbor neighborless. For ere thou wouldst neighbor annoy, these kinds of quiet to destroy, thou rather wouldst to help that matter at home alone fast bread and water. As John Heywood recognized, living in an apartment complex, whether it's the 16th century or modern times, makes one well aware of neighbors to the left, to the right, above, below. Sometimes such neighbors are heard, but rarely, if ever, seen. It becomes easy then to concoct a fantasy life about people we only know through our auditory sense. Consider Robert Wrigley's poem, Praise Bob, from his most recent collection. Under the title, the poet includes a specific address, 623 South 3rd Street West, Apartment 3, Missoula, 1974. That gives the poem an air of authority, as though the poet wants to assure us, before the first full line, that what we are about to read is the truth. We could even stroll around Missoula, Montana, and locate this residence, where once the poet, as is suggested, lived below a curious neighbor. Unlike John Heywood, Wrigley's speaker is well aware of his neighbor. But, like Heywood, he has no complaints. This is Robert Wrigley's Praise Bob. The fact that our first names, the young man I was and the young man who lived in the apartment below mine, should be the same, meant little to me, until the night someone in his bed woke me with the most musical moans, then cried out, "Oh, Bob! Oh, Bob! Oh, Bob!" No sleep for me after that. The next morning, I rose before sunrise, made coffee, and sat at the kitchen window, hoping to get a glimpse of the one who had called. But no one ever showed, except Bob himself, dark-haired, of medium build, wearing a red tie and a black jacket, carrying a lunchbox shaped like a barn. He strolled a foot above the ground and brought forth, with a quick flick of his wrist, an already lit and half-smoked cigarette. Then he stopped and turned back to his apartment door, toward which he gave the merest nod and a wink, then spun to a blur and ascended into the clouds. Robert Wrigley's Praise Bob. we rely on the testimony of one neighbor, Robert Wrigley, another Bob, for the veracity of this miraculous event. There are 6 tercets in this poem, 6 3-line stanzas, and upon first hearing it, we really don't know where it's going. Will the speaker call out to neighbor Bob, and if so, to congratulate him and his happy sheets? Will he seek advice from his neighbor for how he might provoke such a grateful response from a voice so lovely with the most musical moans? Neighbor Bob exits the apartment complex wearing a red tie and a black jacket, which sounds like he might be headed for an office, and he carries a lunchbox shaped like a barn, which suggests his workplace might be a construction site, a notion that makes little sense since he's wearing a jacket and tie. But my inquiry may be too particular. This smoking neighbor rises into the air, his elevated status made flesh, and the woman, whom the other Bob, perched by the kitchen window, hopes at least to glimpse, to put a face and body to the musical moaning voice, is nowhere to be seen. There's much to be mystified by in this poem. Again, Robert Wrigley's Praise Bob. The fact that our first names, the young man I was and the young man who lived in the apartment below mine, should be the same, meant little to me, until the night someone in his bed woke me with the most musical moans, then cried out, "Oh, Bob! Oh, Bob! Oh, Bob!" No sleep for me after that. Next morning I rose before sunrise, made coffee, and sat at the kitchen window, hoping to get a glimpse of the one who had called. But no one ever showed except Bob himself, dark-haired, of medium build, wearing a red tie and a black jacket, carrying a lunchbox shaped like a barn. He strolled a foot above the ground and brought forth, with a quick flick of his wrist, an already lit and half-smoked cigarette. Then he stopped and turned back to his apartment door, toward which he gave the merest nod and a wink, then spun to a blur and ascended into the clouds. Robert Frost, John Haywood, Robert Wrigley, Impressions of Neighbors from Over 100 Years Ago, from the 16th Century, and from Our Own Modern Times. Our theme music is Going to the Sun by Philip Auberg from his CD Live from Montana, available at sweetgrassmusic.com. Thanks for listening to Poems for Company.